Welcome to the Barnes & Thornburg Podcast Network. You're listening to Trial Ready, a podcast dedicated to learning about the work of trial lawyers and their insights into the legal issues of today. To learn more, visit us online at btlaw.com.
Welcome back to Trial Ready, hosted by me, Michelle Bradford. And usually I have my co-host, Mina Sinfeld, but ironically, Mina is in trial, and so she can't join us today. But that's okay, because we're going to keep things moving. And today, I am honored to have with me another trial legend working right here at Barnes & Thornburg, Dave DeVillers, who is fresh out of court after back-to-back trials. I am so excited to have you, David, and I can't wait to hear about your recent trial experiences, as well as your experiences as a U.S. attorney and an AUSA and a state prosecutor. But first, I have to start with my preliminary questions. Who are you and what do you do?
I'm a partner with Barnes & Thornburg, and I do mostly white collar and investigations, both litigation and investigations. Some civil, but mostly white collar.
And where did you grow up?
I was a bit of a nomad. I grew up mostly in New York, both in the city, a little bit in New Jersey, and upstate.
What do you characterize as the city? Because, you know, I am a New Yorker from the Bronx, so I have to qualify that statement.
Still, not Matt, Queens.
Okay. I'll take Queens. All right. Yeah. What's the best place you've traveled to and why?
The best place? I would say Tbilisi, Georgia, the Republic of Georgia. And because it was just the most unique city, very, very friendly. It's right in the Caucasus, just a different, you know, it's not Europe, it's not Asia, it's a little bit of everything. And it's, I lived there for 2 years, and it's one of these beautiful old cities that, you know, we didn't bomb, the Germans didn't bomb, and the Russians didn't bomb. The Russians messed it up pretty good, but they're doing a lot better on their own right now.
Oh, that's awesome. Was that work related?
I was the resident legal advisor for the Department of Justice there for 2 years.
Oh, that's awesome. And then our most important question, which, you know, this number just went up for you because of your two recent trials, but what's your number?
Number of what? Trials?
Well, number of trials? Of course, we're a trial podcast.
I might have gotten over 90 now. I think I was at 87. Oh, no, so I think it's 89 jury trials. Yes.
That's amazing. I mean, you get those kind of numbers because you were a state prosecutor and then you did federal prosecutions. It's very hard to get that number just doing federal prosecutions, right?
It is. Yes. I think I might be 30 federal prosecutions, 29 maybe. And that's, you know, I did 10 years as a state prosecutor and 20 as a federal prosecutor. So, you know, that's there's a big difference.
No, amazing. Amazing. And so I want to jump right into the two most recent federal court cases you had. You had first a case involving a full acquittal of your client against DOJ. I mean, hurrah, hurrah. And then recently you had another case where it was a CJA case, and that wasn't a full acquittal, but we're going to talk about them both. First, let's start with the acquittal. How do you feel having gone up against your old office and having won?
So technically, it wasn't my old office because it was DOJ fraud. Okay. So it was a fraud session case. And trust me, the people from my old office remind me of that, that it wasn't the Southern District of Ohio, although it was, you know, tried in the Southern District of Ohio. It was great. You know, it was one of these cases where, let's face it, we have cases where we truly believe our client is not guilty of what they're charged with. And there are cases where you're pretty sure your client's guilty, right? But you're going to do your best. And this one, I really think it was overreach by the fraud section. And I can get a little bit of it, but there's this animal within the DOJ fraud section called ARPO. And they're really kind of in a region, Michigan, Pennsylvania, Ohio, West Virginia, Kentucky, and Tennessee. And they came in maybe 12 years ago and started doing some really good work when it comes to pill mills and pharmacies. You know, we have a huge fentanyl, back an Oxy and Percocet problem. Did a great job helping us kind of shut those down. And by us, I was the AUSA and U.S. attorney at the time. Right. But quite frankly, you know, in the past four or five years, that low-hanging fruit doesn't exist anymore. And they seem to, and I'll just flat out say it, they seem to have this budget that's not going away. So they're picking targets that really should be, you know, situations where that may be malpractice, maybe a suspension or of their license by the states. You know, we have a state medical board, and they're indicting these family practice. You know, and this guy was Dr. Kissler's a family practice guy. You know, they just flat out didn't warn him. They didn't say, hey, we don't like your prescribing, you know, habits, nothing. Just indict him for a Title 21 offense, which, you know, is prison time. This guy's 78 years old, never, no priors, never even a suspension. And, you know, they hit him with 8 counts. You know, their offer was, you know, 11C1C to 2 years in prison. You know, I do think that I if we have time, we get into. I think they also have issues with their experts that are disturbing. I think to a large extent, even when I was U.S. attorney, I didn't want to sign their indictments anymore. I said, well, you've got the fraud division; they can do it, and I didn't. I wouldn't sign their indictments; they'd have to do it themselves. And I didn't. You know, we of course let them use the courts and our grand jury, but that's about as far as I went with it.
Well, first of all. Even with everything you said, like knowing the problems with the prosecution, it's always a huge risk going to trial, especially when you're dealing with the kind of client you had who was elderly, had never been in trouble with the law. I guess, what gave you the confidence that you could persuade the jury, and what really worked, do you think, in persuading the jury of finding your client not guilty?
Well, something happened between the time of the indictment and the time of the trial, and that was the Ruan case. And Ruan was a Supreme Court case where the jury instructions changed slightly, but I think really importantly throughout the country, in that the it's not just that. And what he was charged with was unauthorized prescriptions, but saying that the prescription had no legitimate medical purpose and it was outside the course of usual medical practice. Which when you hear that, it sounds like, you know, maybe malpractice, you know, maybe lose a suspension, maybe something civil, and. The Supreme Court said, yeah, we agree. It's not just that that's the case. You have to prove that they knowingly or intentionally provided an unauthorized prescription via, you knew it was not a legitimate prescription. He did it anyway. And so our case got a bit stronger after the indictment to the point where I was a little bit surprised they didn't consider dismissing the indictment, but they didn't. In fact, they wouldn't even consider anything lesser than they asked, you know, offers before. They were going full on. And you know, we went over all the risk with our client, and you know, it wasn't just the prison time that he was concerned about. In fact, we would have an argument. We wouldn't plead to 11C1C, you know, which is, you know, mandatory, you know, agreement. We would have just pled to the indictment in front of Judge Marbley, who was the district court judge, and fight for a lesser sentence. But we weren't going to do that either. And he was adamant. And we told him, look, here are the risks. We think you have a strong case, especially based on the jury instruction we'll get, but there's no guarantees. And he was still adamant about going.
No, and that's awesome that you got exactly what you thought you should get, because we know juries are so unpredictable. Was there a moment in the trial where you kind of looked at the jury and said, they're on my side? You know how sometimes you can look in their faces and feel like, yeah, they're buying what I'm selling. This is actually going very well.
Not until closing arguments and when they're nodding. It's always good when they're going like
that's
this,
right? When they're nodding.
It's bad when they're kind of going like this. And they were nodding, and they as soon as the prosecution got up for rebuttal, they were going like this again. So I thought, all right, this might not be so bad. And they were out about 3 hours.
Wow.
And it was a 2-week trial. Yeah. A lot of it battle of experts. Really, kind of it's kind of a double edged sword when you have these type of cases. There's these things called ORS reports, and that is that every single person, every prescription you give, every prescription that's filled is in a public record a record with other prescribers and the state medical board. So all the pharmacists, all other doctors, everyone will come and can look at that ORS report and know what that patient got or what that doctor prescribed. And I mean, our argument, you know, they're trying to use that against our guy, but our argument was every single time this guy filled out a prescription, he's never, ever a pharmacist who can do this, never saw anything suspicious, always filled it. And all the other doctors that had these other patients because he was family practice for, you know, a back pain or for, you know, surgery, they saw it all. They never said anything, you know? So that was the part you can kind of tell, as we were starting to use that when I, in closing, you could tell that was a big part. They're like, they started, I think they, something connected there.
That's amazing. So just last week you had another trial.
I don't want to talk about that one.
Okay. No, but we're going to talk about that one because, right, this is the way trial work is. Like, you'll be on a high, you just won a case, and then you get another trial, and you're like, what? How did I not get another win? I'm marvelous. Tell me about this second trial you had.
So it was this week. They came back yesterday. The jury came back yesterday.
Wow.
It started on Monday. It came back yesterday. But the issue in this case, you know, was he was indicted for Hobbs Act. That's a robbery with a firearm. And he's a felon. So it's a 924C and a 922G and the Hobbs Act extortion. The bigger problem with this fella is that in 2007, his exact same charge. So if you have a prior conviction for a 924C and you get, even today, even after since the law has changed, and you get charged with another 924C, the mandatory minimum is 25 years for that count.
Yeah.
Consecutive to the Hobbs Act and consecutive to the 922G. So he guidelines 40 years, like 38 to 42 years. And then, you know, his mandatory minimum is 25. The prosecutors offered me the mandatory minimum. They said, we'll give him the minimum, 11C1C to it. And, you know, he didn't want to. The problem was, and I'll start with this. So the judge in this case, a district court judge here, I am on a CJA list, and it's, you know, good pro bono stuff for us. I think it's really important to try to get on CJA lists. So because the connections to the judges and the staff, and it's good pro bono stuff. But fortunately, you know, I say that, but then I get called to trial, right? So in this particular case, the judge asked, it was a relatively difficult client. He had fired two other CJA attorneys and then asked if I would do it. I said, I'd rather not. He's asked me again. So I was doing this case. And I got along with the guy fine, quite frankly. But the problem was there was a videotape of the crime. It was videotape. He was wearing a mask, but he had the same clothes on, same shoes, same hoodie. He took his mother's car, and he maced the girls that he robbed. It was a T-Mobile store, which wasn't good either. Gets into a car. They put a bait phone in the car. So they chase. The cops know exactly where he's going, where he is. They chase him. He goes on a high-speed 90-mile chase through downtown Columbus, crashes the car. They get out. They tackle him with the gun, with the mace, and with the stolen phones. And it's in his mom's car. He confesses to the police at the scene. And when they're telling him, you shouldn't say anything. Don't talk to us. Because I want to know how you caught me. And you know, he figures a bait phone. Goes to the police station. Read his Miranda rights. Full confession. We tried to suppress the statement. We had a hearing. We lost.
Yeah.
But he just would not. He would not plead anything.
Well, you know, I am on the CJA list here in DC, and I agree with you. Like, they're important cases, and you have to really abide by your client's desires. You advise them as much as you can, and explain as much as you can. But they have the absolute constitutional right to go to trial and make the government prove its case. And so I guess in that trial, how are you feeling? I mean, obviously, even when you know the facts are stacked against you, there's always this hope, I think, as a trial lawyer, like, maybe I'll convince one or two. Maybe I'll get someone to see it differently. Did you have that feeling at all?
You know, kind of. And here's why. I actually know the ATF agent on the case. You know, the things he was saying was really to a point about knowing the phones were stolen, right? To the cops. And in the interview, he does take full responsibility for the robbery, but all of the information is not inappropriately spoon fed to him, but it was, hey, you got to tell us about the robbery at the T-Mobile store. Where'd you get the gun? Why'd you mace the girls? You know, and he answered these questions, but they were all put to him. So I think I tried to intimate that he was protecting somebody. Right. And they had the bait phone. So we knew the GPS coordinates to it. And 2 minutes after robbery, the phone stopped moving for 2 minutes. And there was a parking lot. There's this old parking lot there. And, you know, I'm not going to get, don't have to get any attorney-client privilege stuff, but there's an argument that he stopped there. Whoever had that did that robbery stopped there for a while. So something could have been an exchange of phones. You know, could have been something. He could be protecting somebody. So, you know, it didn't – I think it kind of – and I got a couple nods in my closing. The only problem is when in rebuttal, they got a lot of nods too, and they got more nods than I got. So, you know, in the end, I kept them out a couple hours, but you know, they came back.
And was that case against your former office or was
– It was.
It was.
Oh, trust me. It was crowded. it was definitely crowded. Against even my own, one of like this agent that I've worked with forever. And I've cross-examined two agents that I've worked with so far. And, you know, every time my shtick is when I get up and cross-examine them, I pronounce their name wrong. And I'm like, this guy was Bash. I go, is it Boesh? They're just looking at me. Biash? Bash? Biash? Besh? Yeah. So I just at least have some fun with that part of it.
You have to have fun with it, right? I mean, and that's why we do this kind of work. Did you ever think in private practice you would have like two trials within weeks of each other?
No, federal trials, right? No, I didn't. But that's how it worked out.
Well, I know it's so funny. So it's so common in when you're in the government to have back-to-back trials. And so you were an AUSA, a state prosecutor, and eventually the U.S. attorney for Southern District of Ohio. What was it about government service that kept you there for so long?
I like being a prosecutor. I liked presenting cases. I like building cases. I liked investigating cases. I did a lot of kind of RICO, organized crime, some corruption stuff, you know, some international, you know, stuff too. And I like doing that. I like building a case. And I love being in trial. The one thing, you know, as prosecutors, we don't do a lot of cross-examining. And that's the one thing I really like doing as a defense attorney. I think it's just, it's fun, you know, kind of, and I like the idea of anticipating, you know, what they have, you know, what the prosecution has. Even, you know, maybe in pre-indictment, if we get like a grand jury subpoena or something like that, I like that aspect of it. So both sides have their fun, right?
It's true. As a prosecutor, I loved rebuttal. Oh my rebuttal God. Argument, because you could just save all these little one-liners and dingers.
Yeah.
But now I enjoy cross. Like, you have to live for the cross exam when you're a defense attorney.
Yeah, and it's so frustrating to sit down as defense attorney. I used to always do my rebuttal, right? Even if I was trying a case with somebody, I'd always do rebuttal closing, and you know it's so fun because you're last person to talk. I'm married, so it's rare that I get the last really talk, and so I just loved it. But as a defense attorney, you're sitting there just getting kicked in the stomach over and over again. Like, yeah.
So true. So true. Now, you mentioned a little bit working internationally when you were with DOJ. And I know that you've done a lot of work internationally, like working in Iraq and spending time in Kyrgyzstan. Did I say that right? Because I'm going there like in May. So I got to pronounce it right.
Are you going to Bishkek?
Excuse me?
Are you going there in May?
Yes. It's part of our other engagement. Yes.
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 It's an interesting place.
What was it that kind of drew you to that international aspect of your DOJ work? And what was that like for you?
Well, so I was a state prosecutor, then 9/11 hit. And, you know, I did some salsa work. And, you know, I wanted to, you know, help out with terrorism. And believe it or not, we had a fair bit of it here in Ohio. And so I joined the U.S. Attorney's Office, you know, here. And then they asked if I would go to Iraq to investigate a foreign terrorist organization in 2004. And I did that for like 3 or 4 months. And on the way out, they were talking about working on the Regime Crimes Liaison Office, which was for the prosecution of Saddam Hussein and some of the high-level Baathists. So I stayed. My wife wasn't happy, but I stayed a couple weeks longer in Baghdad and kind of worked on like how would that look, right? How would we go about doing that? And then I came back, and then 2006, 2007, they asked if I would be interested in applying for a position as being the prosecutor liaison for that office to actually, you know, help try Saddam for the particular trial was the Anfal Kurdish genocide trial. And I agreed to do that. They said it was a lengthy interview process, but you know, I remember it wasn't the DAG, but I was sitting there and I remember this on a desk. I'm in DC being kind of interviewed about being one of the people and talking and like, why should we over this? He puts his hand on a stack of like resumes And he says, why should pick you over these people? And I just looked at him like, there's no way you have that many people dumb enough to go to Iraq. And I think it was true. I think it was BS. I really, truly think there wasn't that many people. I think it was like, you know, a couple stacks of paper and some resumes on it. So, but I got chosen and went back for 06-07. I was there for the AMFAL Saddam Hussein trial.
Wow. And so what was your role in that trial? Were you like prosecuting or?
So I was the liaison to the, so Saddam didn't have, all the prosecutors were kangaroo prosecutors or Baathist, you know, they just did his bidding. But he kind of had to let the civil system do its thing. And so we took a bunch of their prominent civil attorneys and made them into prosecutors and worked the Iraqi High Tribunal. And, you know, we worked with them. They didn't know anything about like forensic pathology or, and I actually did do a lot of murders, you know, so I knew a little bit of that crime scenes and, you know, we utilized, you know, kind of the Nuremberg sort of laws, right? So they adopted this, the new parliament adopted those laws. So we kind of helped, it wasn't just me. There's four other guys there, guys and girls there from DOJ, and then some people from the JAG Corps there too. But I was in charge of the prosecution chamber ultimately. And so I would work with them on, all right, we're going to put on this witness. You know, here's this evidence. And then I'd work with the defense attorneys kind of explaining what was going on. And at first I was very much kind of mentoring and coaching the prosecutors. But after a while, because they're not used to an adversarial system, this was kind of adversarial. And, you know, I was behind a glass in the courtroom and, you know, there's no Americans in the courtroom during the trial. It was just all Iraqis. And we had people working the defense. We had people working with the victims, with the judges. You know, everybody was liaison to one of those groups, victims. And, you know, it, after a while, it was really more of kind of, I was helping. But they started rolling after, you know, 6-7 months of trial. You know, they had it down pretty well.
Well, that must have felt so fulfilling, right? Like, to see them kind of be able to stand up on their own and handle the case after your training and working with them.
Yeah, they did a great job.
Well, of all the exciting jobs you've had, I also have heard that you're a technical advisor for the show Billions.
I am, yeah.
Talk to me about how that opportunity came about and what you do for that show.
So the executive producer for Billions, about four, I tried this case 2008, maybe. And it's this crazy case where this guy, it's kind of a old school organized crime guy in Columbus. They did bank robberies. They were in Macon, Georgia, did bank robbery. Got back to Columbus with like $500,000. And this is early 1980s. And it total like, you know, Goodfellas. He started killing off the people he was doing it with because he thought they'd flip. And he's right. He killed a bunch of them and no one knew about it. He and his crew. And then two of them end up testifying against him anyway. They don't kill. And he does 15 years in prison, gets out, comes back to Columbus. And these people are in the witness protection program. But eventually they come back. And both of them, two different people, one in 98, one in 99. And he ends up killing both of them too. We don't find out about it. And I don't find out about it until, you know, there's a long story how we stumble on it, but it's 2006, 7. And so we investigated and prosecuted him and went to trial. And it was a long trial, bunch of murders from the 80s all the way until 98. And so she heard about this and wanted to write a story kind of based on that and based on the prosecution. And my wife, believe it or not, who's a teen fiction author, she liked the contrast. And she wrote a showrunner, like, and they sold it to CBS. They never made it, or they haven't made it. But so she called me, and then she became executive producer to Billions. And so she called me a year ago, you know, right after I left as U.S. attorney, and asked if I would assist the writer's room with the show, which is about a U.S. attorney. And I've never seen it before. So I watched a few episodes and we did it. And so we meet in the writer's room. We go over kind of like what's realistic, what's not. You know, they have these kind of plots like what would happen if this really happened. So it's fun. You know, you work with them as a group to kind of plot out a season. And then you work with them, you know, individually because there's one or two will write each episode. And so that's they're very different writers, different backgrounds. So it's fun to work with them.
That's amazing. Like, you have had the most amazing career, and I wish we had an hour to talk, Dave, because I would ask you so many more questions. But unfortunately, we're running out of time, and we are up to my favorite part, which is your favorite part, right? The cross-examination. And so I will be asking you questions in a cross-examination style. As you know, the rules of cross-examination are you have to answer the question that's asked. If you don't understand, you can ask me to clarify. There is no judge, there is no jury, there is no one to help you. So at the end of the day, you should just answer the questions, okay?
Okay.
Got it. Okay. Got it. So you played football in high school, correct?
I did.
And you walk every day to work, right?
I do.
You also have two dogs, right?
Unfortunately, yes.
Well, and you claim to hate them both. Isn't that true?
Where did you get this information, this accurate information from? But yes, yes. Was this from Miami? Did I have some pops in me?
Your wife is a writer for the Disney Channel, correct?
She's written movies that were turned into Disney Channel movies. Books that turned into Disney Channel movies, yes.
She's also written books for the American Girl doll, correct?
She did, just recently, yeah.
And she selects most of your clothing, isn't that right?
Yeah, that's right.
And she often vetoes the clothes that you pick for yourself, correct?
Often, yes.
Well, then she's doing what she needs to do as a good wife. Dave, this has been awesome. Thank you so much. What final words would you give to an aspiring trial attorney, maybe even a law student who's considering trial work, in terms of how to become a trial lawyer?
The best advice, because I teach it, the one thing I always tell my students at Ohio State is always read the jury instructions before you, even as a prosecutor, before you indict the case. And as soon as you get an indictment as a defense attorney, read the jury instructions. Because people don't do that. And they come to trial and there's jury instructions may look completely different from the elements of the offense. And that's how you win or lose trials in your closing argument, by referring to those jury instructions.
I love it. Well, thanks so much, Dave. And keep kicking butt out there in the Southern District of Ohio.
Thanks, Michelle.